This is the second seminar on Introduction to Historiography, the case of the First World War. And I began last week looking through the kinds of sources. In fact, first of all, what questions you need to answer to identify and situate and evaluate a historian. What are the sources they're using? What are the questions they think are important? Which also includes, of course, what are the questions they do not think are important? How do their sources hopefully make up a corpus, so something which is representative and not anecdotal? What assumptions they have, what methods they use, etc. And I was particularly interested in the fact that you can find new sources, which always sounds a bit unusual. It's 100 years ago, the First World War, but you can still find new sources if you find a way of looking at them that nobody really thought of before. Postcards, and I think that's where we stopped. Yes. Yeah, so here are postcards. Now, postcards were tremendously popular, of course, before Facebook. and they millions of people sent millions of postcards. Yeah. And so it is very interesting to see what people put on them, because very often these are small... This is not the government producing postcards. They are small companies who are producing what they think will sell. I mean, very small companies, very often individuals. And so the fact that, you know, Mr. X thought that this particular kind of humour, this particular kind of joke, would sell a lot, is quite significant, yeah? Because quite often they're people who know, because they're people, you know, who... Well, otherwise they disappear very quickly if they don't discover. And so here you get anti-German posters. You have the German Navy at rest. So this is an anti-German postcard, sorry, not poster. And there are a couple of things they are mocking. Two things they are mocking about the German Navy, which, you know, may not be true. What are the two things they are mocking? Do they look like a very scary Navy there? Should Britain be worried?
No.
So why not?
They're old.
They're tremendously old. They've all got long white beards, yes? No. And is the Navy very active?
No.
How can you...
Yes,
that's right. There's actually a bird's nest in the cannon. And do you know the word for the... And cobwebs. And cobwebs around. Yeah, cobwebs are like spider's webs, but I think that a cob is not a spider. It may be a spider, I'm not sure. Cobwebs. You sometimes find them in your house. Yes, and they also have... They also need sticks to walk around. Yeah. So obviously this is popular propaganda, huh? In the sense, you know, don't be frightened of the Germans, because look at them. And there's another thing which they are mocking them about. The sleeping, yes, I think that goes along with being old and sleepy. But what about the text?
The grass on the boat.
Yeah, the grass on the boat. Why is the grass on the boat? Because it hasn't moved for 50 years or something, and so the grass is growing, yeah? But actually the text... Say, Fritz, when are we going to cut the grass again, don't it? Yeah? Yeah, they're mocking the way they speak English. Yeah, the way they speak English, they speak in this. So, this kind of propaganda is not to be underestimated. This is a very popular everyday a little bit, yeah? And then you have another one there. With the... Kaiser, who is going back to Berlin, because all of these countries are fighting back. Yeah, Belgium, France, Britain, Canada, etc. It never rains, but it pours. Yeah. The poor Kaiser. Now, it is possible to do... I think there's been a pretty good study on this, because somebody got a large number of postcards. And you can find out all sorts of things, because of course you have a lot of anti-Kaiser, mocking of the Kaiser, but you find there's very little attacks on the German people. Very few. Yeah? Unlike in France, yeah. So the kind of things you can find out, if you have 1,000, you can find something out. If you have 2, it's not easy to say anything, because they could be the exception. grandiose approach. This is from the Ulster, so the Northern Irish regiments, and the Red Hand was originally a symbol of the whole of Ireland, but it has become a symbol of the Protestants of the North. The origin of the Red Hand is in fact a myth. I can't remember the exact myth, but it's the first time the heroes came to Ireland, and I can't remember if they are gods or heroes, but they were arriving in the boat, and somebody said, the first person who touches the land is the king, and one man cut his hand off and threw it so as to be the first, yeah? Well, myths and legends are usually full of blood, yeah? And so this is the Red Hand, is the bloody hand which arrived first. But it's been taken today to be a symbol of the Protestants of the north of Ireland. Now, Ireland was the only part of the United Kingdom. Remember that before the First World War, Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, all of it. And it was the only part of the United Kingdom where there was widespread revolt against the war campaign, and later against conscription, and in fact the British government decided not to introduce conscription in Ireland. Ireland was conscription was introduced in 1916 in England and Scotland and Wales, but not in Ireland. Why not? Well, they were frightened of a very mass opposition, and of course once you get opposition in one place it can spread. And secondly, they did seem to be rather worried about religious questions, of too many Catholics in the army. I think also they considered them to be disloyal. They thought, you know, should we really give guns to 200,000 Catholics? Maybe not such a good idea, they were thinking. and there are many good reasons to think that that this is true, that there wasn't, that the mass of people in Ireland didn't really care if the British won or not. Some of them did. Many thousands of Irish people did join the British Army. Although the British Army had to organise it in a rather special way, so they had to make sure in fact, they had separate regiments for the Protestants and the Catholics. But on the other hand, in 1916, there was the rebellion against for independence in Dublin, the Dublin Rising of 1916, and although it was not a mass rising, it had widespread sympathy. You see the echo of some of this today, because it's of course the centenary of the First World War, and the Irish government in Dublin have a little bit of a problem. Because part of the Irish narrative is that the First World War was in favour of the British Empire. That's true. And therefore, the people in the Irish government said, well, you know, some people said, well, why would we celebrate the centenary of the First World War? We escaped from the British Empire. The north of our island is still occupied by the British Empire. So, you know, we're not going to celebrate the centenary. But the Irish government, over the last 20 years, has been getting close to the British government. Economic ties are very high. There is a lot of cooperation between the North and the South on different issues now, economic issues mostly. And so upsetting the British government's not such a good idea. And so the poor old Irish government, when it came to 2014, have this kind of dilemma, you know, can we organise a large number of ceremonies to say how wonderful the men who went to fight the First World War were? On the other hand, we can't ignore it. And they came up with what I consider to be a stroke of political genius, because of course most of the Irish population would prefer to celebrate 2016, the centenary of the Dublin Rebellion, which produced the national heroes, James Connolly, Patrick Pearse, the people who were killed, who were executed after the 1916 uprising, are the national heroes. The big avenues in Dublin are named, you know, Connolly Street and Pearse Square, and there are statues of them everywhere. They are the national heroes of independence. So many people would prefer to celebrate this centenary, and so the genius response of the Irish government has been to organise a decade of centenaries, une décennie de centenaire, where they will celebrate together 1914, the beginning of the First World War, 1916, the Dublin Centenary, 1913, the enormous strike in Dublin, the enormous strike and lockout in Dublin. So they're trying to kind of like put them all together and hope that politically it will be okay. It's quite extraordinary, really, called a decade of centenaries. Yeah, somebody thought of this in a little office somewhere. I think it's pretty clever. So that's just to as an offspring. We're still on the sources. This is the postcards, and this is more of an official postcard, because the government does produce some postcards. The kitchen is the key to victory. Eat less bread. There was a lot of campaigns to get people to eat less bread and less sugar and so on, because the less that people eat, the more of the economy is available for the war. Postcards. And a classic one here. Why ain't girls in the army? Just tell me if you can, for they obey the call to arms as quick as any man. Yes, there's a little play on words there. Arms as in guns, or arms as in cuddles. Yeah, so, yeah. It's this is approximately to the level of Edwardian humour. It's not dead sophisticated. Yes, and so they're they are called to, call to arms. It's supposed to be cutes. But it does notice that one of the classics of postcard culture in Britain is things which are slightly risqué. Now, in 1914, to be risqué is not difficult. Yeah, that's but later on, in the 20s and 30s, there will be more and more postcards with jokes about sex. That will be very, 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 even today they're very, very popular. If you go to Blackpool or Skegness and you look, you'll see the postcards of the landscape, and then the cartoon postcards, which will always be schoolboy jokes about sex, really. And very, very popular still today. Less popular than they were in the 50s, but still. Another kind of source. What is this? Sister Susie's sewing shirts for soldiers. Now, what are these two documents? Three documents? Four documents? Yeah, but what are they? Can't hear you.
Anti-war messages?
Yeah, but yeah. What is the object? Yeah, what is the object? No, in fact, only one of them is anti-war. But anti-war what? Yeah, what is it? What is it for? It's not a poster.
What is it doing?
Yeah. Nope, not movies. Not books, no. Theater?
Theater?
Theater? Nope. Sheet music. Yeah, sheet music. The gramophone is invented in the 1890s or the 1880s. But it's very expensive. If you want to buy a gramophone, with the same money, you could go to the music hall 200 times. It's almost the opposite today, isn't it? For the cost of an MP3 player, how many MP3 players could you buy with a ticket to one musical comedy in Paris? Quite a lot. Well, it was exactly the opposite, yeah? That the normal thing to do for singing is to go to the music hall. It costs very, very little. And the gramophones are really expensive. So if the gramophones are really expensive, sheet music is bestsellers. If you get a successful song, you can sell a million copies of the sheet music. Of the La Partition, sell them, but massive, massive market. Yeah, the sheet music, yeah, that's right, yeah, sheet music. Now, one of the reasons is that there were 4 million pianos in Britain. Absolutely. Well, there's a little variety. Yes, they were especially around at home or in the pub. Yeah. But like you said, there were 4 million pianos. It's absolutely enormous, yeah? A piano for every 8 or 10 people. Including in the working class parts of town, the working class had pianos too. Not, of course, the working class didn't have very good pianos. But pianos was big, big, big. And also, you didn't have to play it around the piano. You know, if you couldn't afford a piano, the banjo. The banjo was tremendously popular. Really, really big. So the sheet music was the center of the music industry. In fact, there were two centers to the music industry at the time. The gramophones and the records, that exists, but it's a small market until the 20s. So sheet music and theater tickets. There were 300 or 400 music halls in London, and hundreds around the place, and this was the centre of the music industry. And so it should be possible to write a history book based on the sheet music of the time. If you collect, supposing you collected 1,000 songs, then you might be able to say something about what people wanted to sing about. And that's what I did. And this is my book about 1,000 songs from the First World War, post-publicité. Okay, la chanson populaire en Grande-Bretagne pendant la Grande Guerre. So this is when I learned about it. The best way to learn about history is to write a history book. It takes a long time. And nobody had written anything about First World War popular song in Britain. It was a new subject, and it's coming out in English in August. Okay, still a couple more sources. Yeah.
Again. Are you going to translate?
Oh, I have translated it myself. It also takes a long time actually. It takes 6 or 8 months solid work to translate it, even if you wrote it yourself. That doesn't help that you wrote it yourself. Well, it does help a little because you can change things if you can't find the words. But it does take a long, long time. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, you can't make a lot of money with history books. You really can't. It hasn't come out in English yet.
In French,
a few hundred. You don't sell more than that. You know, so you can't make money. The way you make money with it is you get, because you have the book, you get a promotion at the university. Yeah, that's how it works. It might be able to sell a lot in Britain in English, perhaps. So obviously, it's about Britain. Okay, more sources. Literary works written during the war. Yeah, now this is tremendously popular. There are lots of books written about writings during the war, and in particular at the moment, a lot about women writers during the war. Because obviously the centre of much history of the First World War has been men, there's been a particular effort to write about women. These sources which I've chosen, the war poems of Siegfried Sassoon are very good and also very well known. The war poets, I mentioned last week, are some of the most popular poets in Britain. George Bernard Shaw is the most famous today, the most famous playwright from the beginning of the 20th century. And he wrote a whole series of short plays about the war, which are not very easy to read. You can find them free on the web. They're not very easy to read today. They don't appear to be very interesting or good, but he wrote those at the time. On the other hand, H.G. Wells, who was the novelist, can you name any of his novels, H.G. Wells? I'm sure that there are some which you know. The War of the Worlds, La Guerre du Monde. Say again. I think they made a book out of it afterwards. Yeah, okay. Yeah, H.G. Wells wrote The War of the Worlds. Any more that you know of H.G. Wells? Kipps. What else did he write? The History of Mr. Polly. There was one more which is very, very famous. The War of the Worlds is the most famous, but there's another one. Oh, The Time Machine. La Machine à remonter le temps. That, yeah, he must have based all of his books on movies. Yeah. Okay. But the it's interesting because Mr. Britling Sees It Through is the novel about the wartime. And in my opinion, it's much better than his most famous novels, The War of the Worlds and so on. It's actually very, very good and quite subtle. So in here, he has some characters who are very much in favour of the war and others who are not so sure. And there's lots of tragedy and debate going on, which is very interesting. Okay. So literature written at the time, or of course, naturally enough, and here are some books written about literature written at the time. Then on the right you have Agnès Cardinal and other people, Women's Writing on the First World War. And on the left, Santanu Das, who is one of the gentlemen who wrote mostly about India and the First World War. And he wrote this about touch and intimacy in First World War literature. So he takes the literature during the war and say, how do they deal with questions of personal intimacy? Yeah? So it is a history book, but it's also literary analysis. You've got a kind of mix together here that can go on. Okay, so we're seeing a very, very wide book. Now, the poems are the ones that have had the most influence connected with the war. And here are two of the most famous pieces. First of all, Rupert Brooke, who writing at the beginning of the war, "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by sons of home." So, a rather well-written, obviously nationalist poem. Yeah, the wonderful thing about dying is at least a part of England will be somewhere else. Okay, it's not a 21st century sentiment. But the more popular poems of the First World War tended to be anti-war poems, like this one. "Gas." Oh, this is Wilfred Owen. "Gas, gas. Quick, boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time." But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. "If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori." So, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It is sweet and fitting to die for your country. Qu'est-ce que c'est doux de mourir pour la patrie? But according to Wilfred Owen, then the old lie. Yeah? So this is an anti-nationalist piece. One of the most famous poems in England. Have you seen this before? No? Okay. So if people in England know three poems, this is one of them. Yeah. Pretty powerful stuff. They learn them at schools. What is the most famous poem that you learn in France? If there's one poem that everybody knows. That's right, yes, Si la rose s'éternit ou quelque chose. Yes, that's right, yeah, okay. Good point, yeah. Aha, okay. More sources. Literature written later. Now, that's a source, that's a kind of new source, because it used to be the case, 30, 40 years ago, people would say, if you wrote a book about novels about the war written later, people would say, well, that's very interesting, but that's not history. Yeah. But today this is recognised as one kind of history, looking at how the events and the experiences are represented later. Now, we will see that this causes some debate. Is it really history? Is it not really history? Who knows, yeah? And here are two of the very influential writings. First of all, 1929, Erich Maria Remarque, Investum nicht Neues, en français? À l'Ouest, rien de nouveau. Yeah. All quiet on the Western Front, en anglais. And this is a very, very bloody and negative view of the war, written by a German in 1929, which had an enormous, which sold millions around the world in English and in German, and really helped to crystallize the rising negative view of the First World War. But they keep writing them, so in 1993, there you have The Birdsong, a novel of love and war, which became a television series, not just a film. Yeah, this is even more modesty, became a television series. So it is possible to write analyses of literature written later, which is we will look at that a little later. Sources, we've nearly finished the sources. Paintings. Paintings of the time. How did artists see the war? And here you have two examples. Probably the most famous First World War painting, Mark Gertler, a Jewish man who moved to, I don't know if he moved to England or if his parents moved to England. This, I can't remember the name of this, but it's meant to represent the war. And you can see that it's just going round and round and nobody can stop it. This is the idea. It's a sort of anti-war message. Yeah, it's going round and round and nobody can stop it. And the humans are looking rather inhuman, really. Especially in 1916, which is right in the middle of the war. Yeah. On the other hand, this is an official painter painting the battle. Every army organized official painters, official artists, to go and make official pictures of the official war. Which politically is very interesting, the idea that an army would want an official artist, just like you have official photographers. And of course they are expected to represent some things and not others. What's this then? The cinema of the time. Now, the first cinema is in the 1890s, but by the First World War, the cinema is big business. Charlie Chaplin is the star. The very first full-length film, an hour and a half long, is in 1917, I think. Yeah, so in the middle of the war. But shorter films were already very, 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 very common. And this particular film, The Battle of the Somme, was taken in France during the battle, and it caused a massive scandal because you saw pictures of dead British soldiers, and it caused a tremendous scandal. Remember, nobody had ever seen a battle, because cinema was the first, you know, there was no television, not many photographs in the newspapers either. Quite difficult to take photographs of a battle because you have to everybody stand still for 30 seconds, please. Not easy to do in a battle. And the Battle of the Somme then was tremendously controversial. And for the first time after the Battle of the Somme, the government said, we need to control the cinema. And so they set up a new committee to check that what was going on in the cinema. And so there has been a certain amount of work on British cinema, and there you have the book, British Cinema and the Great War. And there's some very interesting historians working on this, and I listened to one of them a couple of years ago, and he was working on the music, because if you can imagine a silent movie, of course there's no music, no song, so how do you get music? Well, where's the music come from?
You have somebody under the stage or front of the stage and who's playing.
With a piano, absolutely. There's just the film and man with piano. However, how did they choose what music to play? Well, when the producers sold the film, they also sent a book of recommended music. And these books of recommended music are somewhere in some archive, somewhere nobody ever looked at them, until this gentleman, only 10 years ago, said, it'd be interesting to see what kind of music they recommended for battle scenes, for sad scenes and so on. And he went and looked at it, and he wrote a whole history of what the music was recommended, and it's very surprising. Very, very joyful music for battle scenes, etc. And a lot of interesting things to say about it. So this is an example of a historian who found a new source. The source was there, but nobody had looked at it. Because, you know, why would you? You have to have the idea, first of all. Yeah? So that's the work on the music surrounding the cinema. They had some debates about the Battle of the Somme, because some of it was staged. Yeah, some of the filming was staged. They got some soldiers like, okay, do this. You pretend that you're dead. Yeah. Which is cinema of the time. What about this then? This is quite a new discipline. About 25 years old. I mean, you know, new. I'm old, so. Oh, I gave it you. Archaeological finds. Now, we generally think of archaeology as digging up extremely old societies. Egyptian archaeology and perhaps medieval archaeology. But it's also possible to have modern archaeology and the Great War Archaeology Group started about 15 years ago, going to France and digging up the battlefields to see what they could find. Obviously matching it with written sources to try to understand. There are now quite a number of books on archaeology and the First World War, and this is an example of something they found. Because they could find out a lot about what the soldiers really ate. How religious were the soldiers? Well, if you find a lot of religious objects, that might have a meaning. So even though we have such a tremendous mountain of writings from 1914 to 1918, that doesn't mean you can't find anything from the objects, because the objects say things which people didn't necessarily want to say. They're just bits of reality which happen to be around there. One of the things certainly they found very frequently was little pieces of sculpture and art that the soldiers had a lot of time to do things. It seems to be a typical experience for a soldier in the First World War appears to be 3 months of boredom and then one day of watching your friends die and then 3 months of boredom. It's not the case that they were fighting every day. Definitely not. So, archaeology. And this is another one, which is... What is it? Yeah, it's a memorial. It's a monument. There are thousands and thousands of monuments, mostly created in the 1920s. And they have a text on them. To the everlasting honour and glory of the 8,814 officers, non-commissioned officers and men of the York and Lancaster Regiment who fell in the Great War. And of course, you can use the, if you have 1,000 monuments, yeah, you can use, so here I think you see there are no people in the monument. There is equipment and clothes, but no people. In this one you have a cross, a Celtic cross. And this is the biggest one. This is the National Memorial in London, the Cenotaph. And It was supposed to be temporary. It was intended to be temporary. I think it was in wood at first. And then, and it was so popular that it was made to into a permanent one. It's still permanent today, and every year they go and lay flowers, of course, and so on. But the most interesting thing about this monument is what is missing. Can you see what is not there?
Scriptures?
Say again?
Any scripture? No.
Exactly. Anything religious. There is nothing religious at all. Yeah. So this is the question of what is not there. Yeah. Britain was still a very religious place, like most of Europe in 1918, and yet the main national monument has no cross, no in the name of God, nothing at all. And it simply says, very, very simple, the glorious dead. So not to the glorious dead, or in thanks to the glorious, just the glorious dead. So very, very simple. And it appears to be in the shape of a coffin, maybe? It's hard to say, yeah? But there is something, there's a lot to be said about this question of nothing religious on a monument for the dead. There's something very, very special going on here. So certainly if you had 1,000 monuments, you could say, oh, you know, what is the place of religion in monuments in the 1920s? Yeah, so that's a history book. You can do it. It can be done. Slightly exceptional monument in France. In Gentilly. Can you see what is exceptional about this monument? That's not so exceptional. It's quite common. In fact, in most towns they have names. Can you see what's written just under the names? Oh, right, okay, you can't read it. Okay. Maudite soit la guerre. Donc, c'est ça qui est exceptionnel, maudite soit la guerre. So this is obviously quite the opposite of a glorious. And it is well known because it's exceptional. It has maudite soit la guerre and the statue of a little boy, a child, saying that war is such a terrible thing. Monuments.
So it's not the case in Britain?
Say again?
It's not the case in Britain after the First World War. I mean that in France, that what people tend to say is that it was an unnecessary war, and war is a bad thing, basically.
Yes, I do know.
It's the case today. They talk about that war as something very bad.
Yes, I could talk to you for 3 hours without stopping about that question. we will be looking at this question. Let's say that there is a very widespread popular opinion that the First World War was that the First World War in particular was unnecessary and wasteful. However, there was a significant minority who says no, it wasn't. A significant minority. And certainly there is very hard work by one section of historians to defend the First World War. The debate about the First World War in Britain has been on the front pages of all the newspapers last year. So the whole debate is at much higher temperature than in France. In France, if you looked for articles, you'd find them. But if you didn't look, you didn't really find them. So it's a very big question. Which brings up a whole load of subsidiary questions. For example, why is the question more important in Britain than in France? Yeah. Or in Germany? Well, one of the reasons is that it's not very easy to talk about the First World War without talking about the Second World War. And in France and in Germany, talking about the Second World War is tends to be avoided because it's very complicated. Yeah, the French are divided. Yeah, with lots of people helping the fascists and lots of people opposing the fascists. Germany, obviously, it's more complicated. Whereas in Britain, it's very simple. Now, I'm sure if the Nazis had invaded Britain, it would have been the same as in France, but they didn't. And so it's very, very simple in Britain to say, okay, yeah, we were all goodies and we won. And so it's a very simple discourse. which is possible. I do get the impression that in France it's a little bit complicated. Of course, the official line is, oh, there were so many resistance. But, I mean, if there were so many resistance, they must have been resisting against somebody. No, do you not get the impression?
We're talking about the second or the first one.
Well, it's difficult to divide them, I think. But yeah, say the first one. Say the first one.
The first one, my opinion, is that because Clemenceau, who was one of the winner, is probably the one responsible of the rise of the Nazism in Germany. Mm-hmm. When he refused the American and English proposal to erase the debt of Germany's debt.
Yeah.
And you never heard anyone talk about that.
No.
Clemenceau is a hero and that's it.
Yeah. So
the fact is that he is responsible of the he's highly responsible of the rise of Nazism.
Yeah, so it
why
that's one of the
France has problem to look at his past and
yes, that's certainly true.
That tendency of
that's certainly true. Yes,
glorify the French history, whatever, no matter what. I mean,
yes, I mean this exists in Britain as well, but I think that in France it's a little bit more complicated because the Glorious Republic can be defended by the right and the left. Whereas the Glorious British Empire cannot be defended by the left because it's just so based on. So I think the Republican myth is stronger in France than the Empire myth in Britain, for the moment. Okay, it was the end of our sources. So I want to get on. So I want to talk. In fact, I'm going to stop and start again here.